we may have started with this probably a couple of minutes later. If I talk for an hour and a half, I've got two quick files. So I'm happy we're not going to talk that long. We'll be out here a little bit earlier. My name is Paul Bannett. Although it's just open my home from Eagle Eye, I'm actually a minute shareholder in Eagle Eye. I have several other things that I do. One is I work mostly for a company called Beyond Works in Sydney, Australia. And I also do some work at University of Technology in Sydney, where I'm a senior research fellow at the Quantum Computing and Intelligence Research Centre. And so, as you can tell, I'm a computer scientist. As you can also tell, I have no accent, I'm not close to you. So I'm not an actuary. Well, I've been working in insurance for over 30 years now, building insurance applications from a computer science point of view. So today's topic is about really looking at some of the machine learning technologies that have emerged over the years and what some of their attributes are and perhaps their applicability to insurance applications or their non-applicability to insurance applications and what we have to do to them in order to be able to get them to work.
Every brain and your brain and microphone is a big
character. Is that wrong?
Yeah, sorry. Why do you
Okay. So the talk is about machine learning applications and... Hey, they're all happy now. and their use in insurance, or their problems with the use in insurance. So that's really what it's about. So in terms of what I really want to go through today is to look at... first of all, to show you an example result that we've been able to achieve by using machine learning technologies on portfolios that have had GLMs produce pure premiums, where the GLMs have been fitted by consulting actuaries. In other words, not by me, not by a fool, but by people who do this all the time. Then to look at what the motivation for machine learning is. From a computer science standpoint, as you can imagine, people do research on this all the time. I do research on this all the time as well. Look at the types of problems that we can address and that we do try to address with machine learning. Look at some of the data issues, which I'm sure we'll all find familiar. Insurance data probably encompasses all the classic data issues that people find and many more. There are some quite unique things there. Look at some of the methods that are involved that we could look at borrowing and using in certain applications. Look at what some of the modifications that we may need to make to those would be in order to make them useful for something like rate making, for instance. And then look at some results of how we test some of these things, and finally look at the results that we've been able to get on a portfolio that we have where we've had the guidance of some consulting actuaries to do some work on it beforehand. So let me start. So essentially... this is the result. If you don't like this result, or this is not interesting, and if you smoke, now's the time for the next suicide attempt, I reckon, because the rest of it's going to be aimed at producing results like this. So what this shows a portfolio, and it happens to be auto insurance. It's an Australian auto insurance portfolio, but that doesn't really matter. It's only that actuaries in Australia have a long familiarity with GLMs and have been using them for many, many, many years because they were originally trained from the London School. So what the English actuaries use, the Australians actuaries have used for the same amount of time. They pride themselves on how well they rate auto insurance in Australia. They pride themselves on knowing the right compound variables to put in the models, to produce the most accurate models that they believe can be produced using the technology. And so that was the starting point for this analysis, the pure premiums produced by those GLM models. In this case, there are 7 sets of GLMs produced for this single coverage. And the 7 sets were trained on different parts of the claim spectrum inside of this one coverage. So this is not a job that's done haphazardly or without attention to detail. This is a job that's done with attention to detail. What we've done then is essentially looked for, are there systematic patterns in the residuals between the pure premiums that the GLMs produced and the actual claims, the claim signal that's inherent in this portfolio. And so what we've done in this particular case is broken it into a number of segments. You can see segments have numbers. You can see we're computer scientists because the numbers start with zero. No other person would start with zero. We can see the amount of exposure, the amount of GLM, pure premium, put into these things, and we can see the number of claims. And ultimately, there's a spectrum of loss ratios that result from these particular segments, from the theoretical pure premiums that have been put on this portfolio. So these are the kind of results that we're going to look at later. Before we can do this, and we'll look at more of these, and then we'll look at how consistent these are, what I'd like to do is start to look at some machine learning methodologies, especially some of the ones that are employed in here, what the problems with them are, what the opportunities are, and what the modifications need to be. People look after me. He's not my wife. So, why do people want to do machine learning? Well, there are a couple of motivations for this. One is database resources are largely going to waste. You know, we're great collectors, especially insurance companies are great collectors of database information. Banks are the same. We add gigabytes every day of stuff. Decision support, management information systems are not machine learning. We guide those things. We produce reports. They may be ad hoc, and we may do ad hoc queries, but there's not something inside of the computer which is an algorithm which guides the selection of the data that may be important to a task that we want to do. We control all those things. The rate of data collection increases all the time. I know some people who do research on web applications, on mining the web for patterns. And those algorithms become overwhelmed on a daily basis simply because web traffic increases exponentially all the time. I know some people here in the United States who work for the security guys, the spooks here, and they monitor web traffic for terrorists sending messages to each other. And so they face very significant problems in applying machine learning algorithms to try to find people who are communicating with each other in this clandestine type fashion. The other main motivation for this is many years ago there was a big push to build knowledge based systems. People built inferencing systems, and the first one was kind of E. Meissen, and the guys from MIT built forward and backward chaining and probabilistic reasoning. And I was probably one of the earlier exponents of this, and I took this technology up. We produced a system called Colossus in the end, which some of you may know. It's kind of throughout the United States for assessing personal injury claims. That's a classic knowledge-based system. The real problem with knowledge-based systems are a couple of things. One is you need domain expertise. You need someone who knows how to do the problem, and you need to be able to get the knowledge out of them and encode it in some fashion in an inferencing system. Generally, maybe rules was the main way to do that. The knowledge acquisition process is very slow. The main reason for that is people don't know what they know, and it's very hard to get it out of them. We all do things almost subconsciously, especially in our own areas of expertise. I know as a computer scientist, I tend to write code, and half the time I'm listening to music or something while I'm writing the code. Some of my colleagues do that as well. So part of my brain is actually doing something else while I'm writing code because it becomes second nature. But if someone were to ask me, well, how do you write code? Well, I'd have great difficulty in attempting to explain the expertise that I have in writing code so that someone could encode it and we could write it in a machine and build a robot that wrote code like I did. So those tasks become very, very problematic. The other thing is human knowledge is controversial. The lawsuits have started up about expert systems built in this particular way. So what we'd like is to motivate this thing in another way to be able to say, well, instead of having people that we interview in this incredibly slow process to get expertise to put inside of systems that we can use, why can't we just look at the trail of data that a problem leaves and attempt to understand the problem by examining the trail of data? You do that all the time by using GLMs and other methodologies in the trail of data that insurance policies leave in attempt to understand how pure premium should be devised. It's no different. Some of the very disappointing things about machine learning are there are some myths that machine learning tools need no guidance, just like GLMs. Unfortunately, they don't overcome all this. You can't just not think about it. They require no data analysis skills. Of course, you have to have data analysis skills. They require no understanding of the problem. They're different from statistics. Well, none of these things are true. All those things are embodied in every type of machine learning algorithm that people build because of the very nature of the fact that we want to produce results that are robust. So to produce robust results, we need to understand all of these things. Some of those go in the algorithm itself, like some sound statistical theory, and some of them go into the application of the algorithm by the analyst, just as they do now for everything else that we do. There are a number of problem classes which are attacked by some of these techniques, and we tend to think of them in these classes. We tend to think of classification problems. So is it a fraud or is it not a fraud? Is it class A or is it class B? Those types of very simple problems. A lot of those problems from the statistical point of view are tackled by things like logistic regression. Classification problems where we have dichotomous classification, a choice of two things, then logistic regression would be the statistical tool to use. We've done tests using statistical regression on some of these problems, a fraud detection problem actually that we use, and we found that by supplementing logistic regression with some machine learning applications, we were able to significantly improve the performance of logistic regression. And the reason for that is simple. Logistic regression doesn't understand about interacting variables. You have to understand that yourself. For some reason, you have to play God and say, I'll tell you the variables to use, and you use only these. Whereas the machine learning applications tend to look for the variables for themselves, rather. We have another class, which is regression problems, and insurance rating is a regression problem. Obviously, we need to produce continuous output. We need to understand how to produce continuous output from things. There are other problems that are to do with clustering or pattern detection, as they're called. We may want to break customers up into a number of clusters. We may want to do some time series analysis where we assign things to certain clusters, types of events that occur over time. And there are a number of algorithms for doing that. And then finally, there are mixtures of problems where they don't fall neatly into any of these things, but have attributes of both. For instance, we could be doing classification and then based on the classification, a regression based on the results of that. But to do this, you can imagine, if you're going to build an algorithm to do some of this stuff, you need to understand something about data. Logistic regression doesn't understand many of the data types. They need to be numeric, obviously. But we deal with things that are ordinal, we deal with things that are categorical. We have to deal with things that are perhaps massively categorical, and we heard about some of these things in some talks the other day, for instance, about SIC codes and things like that that become massively categorical. Vehicle makes and models are another thing. We have to deal with the issues of the reliability of data, missing data, for instance. I know statistical models don't generally address missing data. A lot of the machine learning algorithms do address missing data values. That's probably the easiest type of misfortune that we could actually deal with in the data. But often we have to deal with skewed data and we have to unlevel it. Sometimes the data is noisy and you can't remove the noise out of the data. But insurance data is characterised by noise, of course. It's probably one of the worst types of data to try to learn from, which is why most of the statistical methods are fairly simple, because they try to overcome the noise that the data has in its influence over the results of the model. We have to deal with data variability. We all have these problems. People change systems. They capture data to a different standard from time to time. Values go crazy. One day they decided to change the way they capture age. Before, they were only interested in if people were under 25, and suddenly then they started capturing the real age. So when they converted, everybody who was over 25 became 26. So when we look at the spectrum of ages, several years later, there's a big spike at 37 because all those people they converted are now theoretically 37. And all those things exist. We have to worry about the size of samples and we have to worry about the implications of testing. And I would say, the computer scientists say, the only way to test anything is on independent validation data. Model statistics derived on the training data are unreliable no matter what the method. If you don't believe me, you have to come to model validation, which is the next talk later, and you'll see why they're unreliable. So let's look at some of these methods that we perhaps could use. The first one's called classification learning. It's a form of supervised learning, which means we have a supervisory function which guides the result of the system, and the supervisory function tries to relate the inputs or the independent variables to our goal or dependent variables. That's why it's called supervised learning. Often it's called inductive learning. So the data set contains examples of the input attributes and the corresponding classification that it is. So that's a very simple example of classification learning. How do these algorithms generally work? Most of these algorithms are what's called greedy algorithms. And the way they work is they examine every input attribute in turn and they find the best possible split in an input attribute. Imagine it's a continuous one, for instance. They find that maybe age, the best possible split in age where you can cut the data set in two that maximises some function. If it's cart, it's Gini. If it's some other tools, it might be a measure of purity or impurity or information entropy. There are a number of these competing functions that we could use to try to maximise this. So then we go to the next variable, find the best cut, measure what the function that we're concerned with is. Maybe it's a Gini score. Until we find the best one, we make that cut in the data. We now have two data sets to work from, and we hand each one of those data sets recursively back to the same algorithm. The only thing we now have to check is, when do we want to stop this process? So there needs to be a stopping criteria, and that's generally governed by data sufficiency type issues. How many do we want to have in a leaf node? Do we want just purity in leaf nodes? Can we handle impurity? So in other words, can there be probabilistic classifications in leaf nodes? Things like that. So the algorithms are essentially, classification learning algorithms are essentially conceptually very simple. You can build one of these in a day. The limitations of classification learning are there's no guaranteed way to find the optimal solution. As with most things in life, this is yet another no guarantee. And the reason for that is quite simple. As soon as we have a greedy algorithm, as soon as we make the very first decision to cut at a particular place, then that's the optimal place to cut at that time. But that doesn't mean that the end result is the optimal result from the very first optimal decisions. And in fact, if we do research on this, we find that often not the best decision at the start leads to a better decision overall at the end. So induction in doing this, the other compromises here, induction must compromise specificity and simplicity. So what that means is basically the depth of the tree. The deeper the tree is, the more branches it has, then the more specific each leaf node becomes. But the more complex the classification becomes. You know, we could describe a branch all the way to a leaf as a rule in the same way as a tree is a tree. What it's really trading off is accuracy versus description length. And again, as with most things in life, that's guided by the analyst. There are decisions the analyst makes about, can I stand a probabilistic assignment? So in other words, can I stand shorter trees where description length is compromised, but is shorter, but accuracy is compromised in such a way? So we can make probabilistic assignments inside of leaf nodes. There are lots of things that do that. So if you want to know how it works, here's a trivial example of what it would find from a data set like this, which I'm sure you can find yourself just by examining the data set. So an inductive algorithm would find this. The very first thing it finds is, if I split on ambience, it's a great variable to split on, and I can get one of those things out straight away. If the ambience is low, the type is B. And on it goes, finding the tree that way. So these, as I said, they're greedy algorithms. They're simple. You can program a lot of these in a day. You just need to determine what your measure, your function that you're optimising across these variables really is. So you could use, again, information entropy, Gini, impurity measures, purity measures. That means you either maximise or minimise them, obviously. And so you can get a tree out like this, which is expressed as rules, obviously, in this particular case, but you could see it would be a tree. What's good and bad about this kind of approach? The really good thing about this kind of approach is you can have massively many attributes, and it doesn't adversely impact the algorithm very much. So it's basically linear to the number of attributes that you put in there. So it's a great way to find which attributes actually make sense in terms of explaining the problem that we're interested in. The results are easy to understand. I know actuaries use CUT to try to identify compound variables. So they do this kind of stuff today. The reason they do it is because it's fast, it can examine a lot of attributes, and the results are easy to understand, and you can encode them in something else. And as I said, it's fast to run, easy to use. There are a number of algorithms to choose from. ID3 was probably one of the very first ones written by Ross Quinlan. He's probably the founding father of this kind of classification learning stuff. C4.5 is his as well. You can download these off the internet. CART, you might have to buy from someone, but it's not very hard. Again, you can program it in a day. OBTree is another one, quite a famous one, built by Osama Fayyad. It was a guy. He's a very famous machine learning person. He used to work for Jet Propulsion Laboratory at one stage. And his infamy arose from the fact that he wrote some naive Bayes inductive algorithm which examined the digital sky survey. And he found a way of identifying objects in the digital sky survey, an astronomical survey. And he ended up writing astronomical papers, even though he was a computer scientist. He became famous for the astronomical papers that he wrote. And he didn't make any of the discoveries. He just wrote an algorithm that made all the discoveries. So it's quite a stunning application of machine learning. The bad things about this is there are no nonlinear effects. In other words, it does one variable at a time. It's really naive in this kind of greedy nature that it has. So if variables do really interact, they only really are allowed to interact serially through this process. There is no natural way of interacting the variables. There's no optimal way of partitioning numeric variables. So it tends to overfit. If we've got continuous variables and we've got noisy data, then all of these algorithms tend to really, really overfit. And the only way we find out that they overfit is we have to keep validation data and see how well the tree actually generalises on unseen data. Consequently, performance is poor on noisy data. That's just an attribute of this kind of simple type of algorithm. The other thing is that there are no algorithm selection rules. So each of these algorithms, ID3, C4.5, CART, and there are a number of others, have different attributes. There's no a priori way of saying, my data set has these attributes, which ones of these algorithms would work best on it? So in other words, there's no way of saying, you have to try a bunch of these things and find out which ones work best. It's a bit like neural networks. How do we know which neural network works best on a particular data set? No one knows. That's an open question. The other thing is regression is uncommon in some of these classification learning things. There are attempts at regression. Quinlan made some attempt at regression at the bottom, at the leaf nodes of a tree, for instance. Instead of actually having a point estimate or a classification, one way of attempting to do regression is to put a linear function at the bottom of each leaf node. The real problem with that is all the functions become discontinuous because you end up at one leaf node, what would be an adjacent leaf node, as a function that's discontinuous with that one. So it's not a very pleasing way to do regression. Another very simple method that's used often in computer science is what's called k-nearest neighbour. And the method is as simple as it sounds. In other words, you decide what k is. And if we're doing claims, you might think it's 1,082, or maybe if you're in California, it's 3,000, or whatever the number happens to be. And you have to find, given that you want to classify a particular case, you find the ones that are nearest to it. Nearest, of course, has a big problem. We have to define what nearest is. So the issues are, how many is K? You as the analyst need to decide. Or maybe you let the system decide, but you need to give it heuristics about how to be able to make that decision. You either encode it up front at development time or you encode some methodology inside that can decide this thing for you. How far away neighbours can be is an issue. These are the issues related. CBR is case-based reasoning. That was an area of active research some time ago. This is related to K-nearest neighbours. So how many K? We could say that up front, for instance. Maybe we're doing claims, and for some reason we think it's 1,082 times some number about variance or something. Or it can be dynamically based on some statistics, like the variance function times something or other, or it can be heuristically based, but maybe it changes for certain claims and certain other claims. For instance, maybe we can develop heuristic rules that we like that governs this approach. The other thing is we can have composites of these where the k nearest neighbours can influence each other, maybe linearly. They all have the same influence over what the desired result is. Maybe there's a Gaussian function that we fit, where the ones that are closest to my target one influence the result more and ones that are further away influence it less. And then we have to worry about, are all directions the same? Perhaps some directions are more beautiful than others. And so we have to encode that inside of the system. In other words, some directions are more reliable. Most applications of these that you find use Euclidean distance, only because it's really easy to understand Euclidean distance. That, of course, gives us great difficulties with categorical data. It gives us great difficulties with developments of biases for axes, because things don't all come on the same scale, so some would have a greater influence than others. Some people encode heuristic distance. In other words, distance is no longer Euclidean. Distance is governed by some rules that people write. So it's an amalgam of k nearest neighbours and a rule-based system that decides distance dynamically inside of the system. And sometimes we can define nonlinear distances that happen to be interactions between variables. So the preferred distances along combined axes that we could use. So this type of k nearest neighbour is very easy for classification when all the neighbours agree. So we're basically in the simplest form taking a hypercube inside of the data, and we say all the guys in here are my guys, and I'll take whatever the average value of this classification is. So when they all agree, that's a very easy decision to make. When they don't agree, it's not an easy decision to make. We can make probabilistic assignment. We may get ties where we have to maybe make no decision in these types of systems. The problems that arise are the sparsity of data locally. So this is the curse of dimensionality. The more dimensions we have, then the sparser the data becomes as we do this, and the distances need to become larger and larger and larger, so we encompass things which look less and less and less like the candidate thing we were after an estimate on in the first place. The other big problem with k-nearest neighbours are edges. If we're doing a classification towards an edge of one of the dimensions, then we've got the chance to fall off the edge. We need to understand that that's going to happen and how we derive reliable estimates in that case. In terms of doing regression with these things, then the central estimate can be based on the neighbours, for instance, providing we're not at an edge. Estimates can be biased by distance, so some neighbours are more important than other neighbours based on preferential distances. We can have something calculate certainties. For instance, if we had claims and we looked at the variance of the claims, we could attempt to calculate some kind of certainty. Even if we understood something about the distribution of the things, then the certainty could be related to the underlying distribution. Maybe it's gamma distributed, maybe it's not. Again, with edges, if we're at an edge, we may need to incorporate a trend from the observations that are near the edge in order that we project the right side. We have an unbiased estimate. If projecting can provide unbiased estimates. And we need to be careful with skewed distributions, obviously, like I just said. Another method this method's been spoken about here at these conferences before, artificial neural networks. Artificial neural networks, you can tell I drew the one on the left. Artificial neural networks have their motivation in obviously brain cells. And these are not new. If you want to use artificial neural networks, you can get almost every variety of network from the University of Stuttgart. There's a thing called SNNS, which is the Stuttgart Neural Network Simulator. You can download all of these things from there and do experiments to your heart's content. So what I want to talk about briefly about artificial neural networks are some of the fundamentals about them, some of the issues with training networks. Networks overfit spectacularly, more than anything else that I've ever seen. Some of the problems with neural networks and some of the variants and the attempts to get around some of the problems with neural networks. So as you know, as I'm sure you know, each neuron has a number of inputs. Each input has a weight associated with it and a bias weight. So it's a linear combiner, essentially, that combines the activation of each input. The weights moderate the sensitivity to that input. The output is really, there's a sigmoidal type activation function that acts on the linear combiner of the input weights, and that determines the strength of the output signal. Pretty simple. Sometimes it's a sigmoidal function, sometimes it's a than. It doesn't matter, so long as it's one of those functions that has a big, that has a differentiable gradient. So that's the mathematical function inside that controls firing, and the firing goes down the line to the next neuron, or neurons, if it's a fully connected network. What we need to do to train this is we need to start the weights in some random fashion, otherwise all the weights are going to go the same way, and we'll never get the network to converge to anything. We need to set the learning function. In most cases, it's backpropagation, which really means backpropagation of errors. And I'm not going to go into deriving the backpropagation algorithm, but you can find those in books, in many, many neural network books. The learning function has to deal with two types of spaces. One is the weight space itself, which is the dimensions of all the weights inside there. So if we've got 300 weights, then weight space is 300 dimensions, and it has to deal with the squared error function at the end, which is the error of the network. So all these networks work on squared error. Suddenly nobody likes them, see? Because squared error can lead to overfitting on very noisy data. The way these things are trained normally is data is divided into training and, well, it's generally called the test set in neural networks, but it's really validation data. And the reason for doing that is these things overfit. So what we do is we train the network on the training data and periodically evaluate it on the validation data. At some point in time, it's going to perform best on the validation data. The error on the validation data will be minimised. Further training reduces the training error but increases the validation error, and that's when we start to overfit. So one of the good things about neural networks is there's a way to find the optimum training for a particular network, and there's a methodology for doing that. So we're not reliant on just training data alone. The bad thing is you need to put aside validation data. But I would say the validation data is incredibly important. So to use it, you need to set some learning parameters. So there's a learning rate, which is usually set to be very small. I've seen some actuarial papers that have dealt with trying to find signals using neural networks, and most of them seem to think that the network should converge after, say, 1,000 iterations. That's not the case. Most networks converge after tens of thousands of iterations through the data. Each iteration through the data is called an epoch in neural network terms, so tens of thousands of epochs it takes to get convergence out of most of these things. We need a set of tolerance, as we say. We need to monitor this tolerance via the validation data so that we find the minimum in terms of error on the validation data. So we train, we test periodically, and we iterate through there. We may want to go back and retune the network. Networks are prone to getting stuck in local minima. You can imagine now we're adjusting the weights in order to minimise the errors, the squared error surface. And the squared error surface is a very complex space indeed. And it does contain many local minima. Networks get stuck in local minima like many other things get stuck in local minima. And that's an issue with them. There are some ways to attempt to get around that. Some ways include like shaking. So, in other words, getting all the weights and just shaking them like that, which really means introducing some noise, periodically introducing some Gaussian noise back into the weights so they shake themselves in some other point in weight space and start the process of gradient descent all over again on the squared error surface. Another way to attempt to get around this is via genetic algorithms. So take the weights as one string so that we can pull them out of the network as one string. That becomes the DNA of that network. And what we do now is we replicate the DNA of that network many times and we make some mutations to it, and then we see which ones of those perform best. And we take those candidates and we bring those to the next generation and we make mutations of them and we cross those over and we breed them, in other words, and create another generation of weights. And we see which ones of those work best next. So this if you do this, you can get away from gradient descent totally if you want. Or you can have episodes of this that get away from gradient descent and attempt to go somewhere else in weight space and then start back propagation all over again. So as I said, the big problem with networks is overfitting. You need validation data to control the overfitting. Otherwise, it'll find a very, very good solution on the training data. The second problem with networks is topology. Given problem X, it's impossible virtually to specify what the optimum number of hidden nodes is in a network to best represent problem X. And people have done some work on this, but there's no definitive answer. There's one very, very classic example of this that demonstrates a lot of the issues with neural networks. If you take a network with two hidden nodes, you can train that network to absolutely precisely reproduce the sine function. It just takes two little hidden nodes to do that job. If after you've trained that network to produce the sine function, you add one more node, one more hidden node. So in other words, now the network is more expressive than it was before. It can represent more complex functions than the sine function. And we retrain that network from where it was, it'll never, ever reproduce a sine function again using backpropagation. So it goes somewhere else and can't retrieve the global optimum that it had before, which was reproducing the sine function without error. So you can understand now some of the brittleness associated with neural networks. They can be great, but they can be not so great. Some of the downsides, so they're all the good things about it. Some of the downside are that it's a black box. In other words, even though the network is trained, we get very little insight into what the hell it's learned. Unlike classification learning, where we get a tree or rules and we can examine that and think, does that look reasonable or does that not look reasonable? There's no way to understand this. So we can't have expert validation of the results of a network. The other downside of this is it can't use the obvious. We can't encode domain knowledge inside of this thing. Some classification learning tools now can cope with domain knowledge. So in other words, we give them starting rules, things that it should know about, and it goes and takes those as given facts and then mines from there. So there's no way to encode that in the network other than to specifically encode weight values inside as a starting point. And that's a non-trivial task. So there are a number of... Remember the brittleness of the sine function, where we just add one node and it just goes... It never, ever finds a sine function again. So people are concerned with that. So people would like to have networks that adaptively change their topology in order to match the problem at hand. One of those types of networks is cascade correlation networks. So they just start with one hidden node and they have a procedure for adding a node at a time until adding a node doesn't produce a better solution to the problem. So this is related, in a way it's related to PCA because they're all orthogonal to each other. When it runs out of expression is when it stops adding nodes again. So that's one that starts from very small and adds nodes until it can do the problem at hand as best it can with a number of nodes via this procedure. Another type of adaptive network is one that starts with an overly expressive network. This is called, there's a couple of algorithms. There's optimal brain damage, there's optimal brain surgery, which is another one which is a bit more radical than this one. But this one basically takes nodes out, which is where the brain damage thing comes from. So it takes out the node that has the least sensitivity to the inputs, essentially. Pulls that out and retrains the network and keeps going until the improvement in fit doesn't... There's no more improvement in fit by doing that. And improvement in fit means improvement on the validation data. This is related to clustering problems, radial basis function networks. Again, you can download all these things from Stuttgart. These have Gaussian activation functions and they're multi-dimensional Gaussian activation functions. And you can think of them as like a little tent that goes over the data that's a probabilistic tent. So you can decide on the number of nodes you have decides a number of clusters that you make from the data. And so what happens is the little Gaussian function inside of this varies in size and its position varies in space in order that the radial basis functions spread themselves optimally over the data. And that's essentially what radial basis functions do. It's a very different application of neural networks. You can see now that it's a kind of a clustering application. Finally, here's another clustering application. They're called Kohonen self-organising maps. And this is completely unsupervised learning where there are no outputs in the vectors. So we're not trying to match any particular goal. All we do is send input vectors into this thing. We create a network which is a two-dimensional lattice of neurons. Each of the neurons has a weight vector inside it which is exactly the same size as the input vectors that we're giving it. And what the network does is it finds the neurons. For each input vector we send in, it finds a neuron that has the closest weight vector in Euclidean distance from the input vector we just sent in. And that's the one that wins. It's often called winner-take-all learning. So whichever one that node is that won, what we then do is we change its weight vector to be more like the input vector again, and we take a neighbourhood around this lattice of neurons and we change their weight vectors to be more like that input vector again. And then we get the next input vector and we do it again. And we repeat this epoch after epoch through the training data. And between each epoch, we do two things. We reduce the amount that we change the weight vector by, so we make it less and less dependent on the input vector, and we reduce the neighbourhood size where the influence of that happens. And what happens is structure crystallises out of the Kahuna network. It's almost like watching ice freeze. And at the end, neurons respond to very different data, spread themselves very, very far away in this two-dimensional lattice of networks. So this becomes a map. And there are some, if you go to the Kahuna, I think it's a university of Helsinki University of Technology, which is where this work was done, you'll find lots of examples of this. They classify, one classic example is they classified countries by their economic data. So you'll find in one corner of the network is the USA and its economy. Not far away is Japan and some of the other Western economies. And at the other end, way up the other end of the network, is the African guys and their economies. And it doesn't know anything about geography. It's just given input vectors which are representative of some economic demographics. And that's what it's doing. So the structure comes out of the economic demographics as represented in input vectors. I think I've just explained all this. It's essentially another simple procedure. And it's very good at unsupervised learning. And it's very good for discriminating different pieces of data. The common issues that arise with all of these machine learning algorithms are several things that we're not going to like if we're dealing with insurance data. The very first thing is all observations are equal. And we know that all observations are not equal. They come in varying amounts called exposures. Some of the algorithms are more amenable to change for that than others. Neural networks are very opaque to change there. It's difficult to change gradient descent to take into consideration variable size observations. The second limitation is all these things take vectorised observations, essentially. You know, we can represent these things, as everybody does in the statistical literature, we represent things as vectors of input values and dependent variables. The real problem is when we look at the insurance data itself, insurance data comes with a variable number of claims. This doesn't look like vectorised data. Claims come as zero, one or more instances to one variable exposure record. And that doesn't look like vectorised data either. The third issue with all of these machine learning algorithms is they implicitly include assumptions of normality. And that we're not going to like either, are we? We'd like to have different assumptions about Poisson error structures and gamma error structures and stuff like that. So these are going to be very poor choices for doing some of the things, for doing rate making, for instance. They may be good choices for doing lots of other insurance applications, and I don't want to dissuade you from using them for other insurance applications, like maybe finding frauds or doing some other tasks. If we can solve some of these problems, if we can address these issues of variable observations, variable numbers of claims attached to variable observations, and different error functions, then we might be able to find we might be able to write an algorithm that finds the residual left behind by GLMs. And that's where we started. So the methodology that we want to employ is to modify these machine learning techniques to search for residuals that the GLMs leave behind when they model pure premiums. To do this, we've chosen, in this particular case, a moderate size, a medium-sized auto portfolio. The premiums are set by a consulting. We have 4 years of data in this portfolio. I'm going to the slide I showed you before contained 1 year. So in these 4 years, we have two lots of consulting actuaries that fitted GLMs to this data. And each didn't like the GLM that the other fitted and thought they did a better job. It's, and they both did about the same job, I think. So the important thing is there's 4 years of data. The GLMs that are used here are fitted on all the data. Like, it's normal procedure for GLMs. No validation data was kept aside by the actuaries. They just fitted all the data and relied on model statistics to determine the best GLM that they could fit. So the pure premiums are derived from all the data. What we do is divide the data set into training and validation. We, in fact, choose only 1 year for training, not four, and we use the following year for validation. So if we find a signal over the top of the GLM in 1 year of data, we test for how reliably that signal exists in the validation data, and we'll talk about some of those tests in a moment. So we want to search for the differences between the pure premiums that have been fitted and the claim signal that arises. So the methodology is we're going to use our machine learning algorithms. We will only expose them to policy attributes. It would be silly, you know. That's just a standard thing that we need to do. As I said, we've got 1 year's training, a subsequent year for validation. We want to derive, we'll do two things. One is we're going to derive point estimates for what are segments, what look like perhaps leaf nodes in a tree, in the same kind of way. They're not leaf nodes in a tree, but they're the same things. They're point estimates. So it's a piecewise constant function. We'll want to control some of the attributes that those segments have, like they need to have a certain number of claims, for instance, in order to be reliable. Yep?
Quick question. When you say 1 year for training, subsequent year for validation, do you mean you'll train on year one, validate on year two, train on year two, validate on year three, and so forth?
No, just 1 year. We just picked 1 year. Out of the 4 years, we picked the third year for training and the fourth year for validation.
And so years one and two, forget about it.
Forget about it, yep.
Okay.
Yep.
The policy attributes, are they the variable used to derive the program in the first place, or some of them are not or not used to derive the pure premium in the first place?
So they are certainly all the ones that are used to derive the pure premium, plus some more that they rejected. So it's all the policy attributes that the actuaries used to derive the GLIM, some of which they used and some of which they didn't. The second task we want to do is to... Oh, sorry.
I'm not clear what you do with year one and two. You use year three for training and year four for testing.
We didn't use year one and two at all.
Okay.
Yeah. Just the actuaries like to use... The actuaries like to use, for whatever reason, I don't comment whether it's good or bad, all the data that they have in order to fit GLMs. That's just the motivation that they have. We thought we'd set ourselves a sterner test than use all the data. We thought we'd just use 1 year of data and validate on the next year. The second task we want to do is we want to derive continuous estimates rather than point estimates for particular sections, particular segments of the business. We want to derive a continuous output and then look at the spectrum of that continuous output by taking bands of that and seeing what the attributes of that are and how reliable it is. And so we'll test the accuracy of the estimates that come out of this thing. So I've just labelled these actuaries A and B. They're just two consulting firms. So this is a result, this is on the training data itself. So this is 1 year of data. So you can see there's, from the exposure, there's a reasonable, this is kind of a medium-sized portfolio. It's not all state, but it's not very small either. So we can see what the premium in each segment is, the amount of claims, which should actually match the premium. If the GLMs were good, I shouldn't find any stratification here. There should be no residual signal. So there seems to be a residual signal in this data. And it's quite a signal. The underlying loss ratios range from 75 to about 130%. It's a pretty hefty size lift inside of this thing. But I may have overfitted, because you don't know, how expressive the model behind this is. If I make the model expressive enough, it can be a memory, for instance. It can remember the claims, and I can get all sorts of good things out of this. So the test is, if I take the definitions of each of these segments and apply them to the validation data, then how discriminating is it on the validation data? How well does it generalise? They're the loss ratios that arise out of the validation data. So it looks like the same sort of lift exists in the validation data. So we're starting to think now, well, maybe there's some systematic nature to the residuals that GLMs leave behind. When people who do know how to fit them, there's a very significant signal here. How can I test this signal? Well, I can get some statistics about this signal. First of all, you can see training versus validation for these segments. There's a big lift here. I mean, no one would knowingly want to miss this if it was in the data. So I can measure certain things about this. I can look at the correlation between training and validation signal. And the correlation is 0.93, so that's pretty good. I mean, this is a consistent signal. But that just means that one could be very steep and the other one could be not as steep, and I could still get a good correlation. So what I need to do is measure the lift of this signal. So the way I measure the lift of this signal is I take the exposure-weighted standard deviation. And we can see that the exposure-weighted standard deviation on the training data is a little bit more than 16%, and on the validation data it's about 14.5%. So the training data overfits slightly by about 10% in terms of the size of the signal. But the actual nature of the signal is very consistent between the training data and the validation data. So what we have is a minimal overfit in this case by about 10%. We're not talking about the kind of overfits that we get in some other things. We're not talking about the types of overfits that we get with GLMs, which can be much, much larger than this. So I think a reasonable conclusion at this stage, tentatively, would be that there's a consistent and large signal present in the residuals, in the pure premium residuals of these GLMs for this portfolio, as fitted by Actuaries Brand A. But that may just be that these guys don't know how to use the tool that they have in order to fit GLMs very well, which is what Actuaries Brand B say. They say those guys aren't very good. We're a lot better, and we know what secret variables to put in that need to interact in order to do this job properly. This is auto insurance. This is not rocket science. I mean, Actuaries have done this stuff for a long time. Oh, sorry, before I get to that, another measure of how well this goes is a measure of fit. So what we calculate for these is the deviance of the GLM premiums, the squared error of the GLM premiums for these segments, and the chi-squared error. And then we use those, we use the loss ratios from training and apply them to validation to correct the premiums as extra relativities, and then we remeasure our new estimated premiums in terms of deviance, squared error and chi-squared error, and all of those improve quite substantially. So these are measured using validation data. Recall, though, that the validation data was actually training data for the GLM. This has already seen that data. It's already inherent in the beta values that the GLM fitted already, because they used all the data to fit the model, whereas this model's never seen the validation data before. So what we find is if we incorporate the relativities that arise from the signal that we found and examine the premiums on validation, we find that the premiums we propose fit much better than the original GLM pure premiums. But that's not surprising, considering the lift that was left in there. So Actuaries Brand B, they attempted the same result, as starting from the same data and derived pure premiums. And then we ran the same algorithm as we did before over their data, and this is the lift that's inherent in their pure premiums. And all this is, really, is represented by interacting variables. There are many, many, many locally interacting variables in this system and in this data. So that's the lift from the training data. That's the lift from the validation data for that same segmentation. It's pretty consistent. That's a simple graph of it. You see there's a bit of a bump in the middle that doesn't fit so well. The correlation's 0.87, so it's pretty close to 0.9. This is a very consistent signal. We can see the exposure-weighted standard deviations, so there's not much overfit The training data does overfit a little bit, but everything overfits the training data. But there's a very consistent signal, generalises very well on the validation data. So we'd have to conclude that there's a pretty consistent and large signal, again present here, on these new pure premiums derived by somebody else totally. In terms of fit, again, we can see the deviance, the squared error and the chi-squared error improve quite substantially over the base model premiums. The other thing we did, as I said at the start, so what we've looked at here is basically segmenting this portfolio into mutually exclusive and exhaustive segments and deriving a point estimate for each one. So in other words, we've seen how much evidence there was in each one. There might be 40,000 years of exposure and 6,000 claims or whatever it was in a segment to derive a point estimate. Another way to do this task is to derive continuous estimates for all of this data set. And in this case, what we do is we ascribe them a value from 0 to 1,000, these continuous estimates, just because we want an invariant measure inside. It's just an attribute of the method that we use. They're analogous to a credit score. They're in the same kind of ranges as credit scores, 0 to 1,000. The more you are towards 0, the better loss ratio you're going to have, and the more you are towards 1,000, the worse loss ratio you're going to have. So we're correlated to that. So if I break up the score bands in this way, so I say 0 to 302 and 303 to 416, etc., you can see now, if you look at the exposure column, it's kind of a Gaussian distribution of exposure rather than much more steady like it was with the segmentation. We've made a more Gaussian distribution by breaking it up this way, and you can see that the loss ratios now start to look pretty dramatically different from the pure premium, the assumptions that the GLM would have made. If I take... Yep.
Under your column premium, that's the actual premium of the data set?
That's the actual fitted premium. That's the actual fitted pure premium from the GLM. Yep.
Oh, okay.
So this is the training data. So you see in that, for 0 to 302, they fitted $1.8 million of premium,
uh-huh,
and they had just about $4 million of claims associated with that.
Okay.
Now, again, no one would do that by design. And the same at the bottom, they fitted $1.7 million in premium but only had $900,000 in claims associated with those exposure records. So that looks like a pretty significant signal, providing it validates well, and it validates like that. So we see it's pretty consistently validated. In terms of graphically, that's what the loss ratios for training and validation look like for these particular score bands, for this continuous induction. In terms of how well it does, the correlation is 0.98 between training and validation, between those bars, essentially, that graph, correlations, which is pretty high correlation. But that's kind of artificially high because we've got some really big numbers there that are very consistent. Looking at the lift, the lift in the training data is a little over 30% of loss ratio, the exposure-weighted lift, and the exposure-weighted lift in the validation data is about 29%. So there's not much difference between them. When we look at inducing continuous variables for these things and then look at the signal that they find, it's a pretty consistent signal, and it's a very, very large signal. If we correct the premiums using the results of these, then you can see, again, the deviance is markedly improved, the squared error is markedly improved, and so is the chi-squared error markedly improved. So these are two different methods for looking at the same data set where GLIMs have been fitted by two different companies of consulting actuaries, and the same things inherit all the time, essentially. This is not an attribute of the actuaries. It's not particularly... well. Summary. I'll go over some of these points, I think. The point estimates that we looked at before, where they were called segments, which is essentially embody a piecewise constant function, derived from the training data, fit that validation much better than the GLM alone. So the improvement in fit statistics is actually very significant. And this is regardless of who fitted the GLMs. It seems to be a constant. The continuous estimates, the scores that we just looked at, fit the validation better than the GLM as well. These have greater lift than the continuous segments, and that's because the continuous segmentation needs to produce segment descriptions which are understandable. Simple. In other words, remember in our tree thing, we're after description, length and accuracy? Well, so the segmentation went for description, minimising the description length, so it didn't find all the signal, whereas this continuous methodology is predicated on, you don't need to understand the nature of what it's found, let's just find the best thing we can. So it maximises the other way in accuracy. So this, the other thing we've tested is those continuous scores we've tested against credit scores, and they can compensate for the credit. If you take the credit score out, the signal in this thing more than compensates for the removal of the credit score. And I know that's topical at the moment because a lot of states are considering banning the use of credit. So that's a big problem for a lot of insurers. So in conclusion, what I'd say is that GLMs overfit their beta values. And I can say that because I'm speaking next at model validation, and so I've done that work as well. What really happens is GLMs overfit. That's essentially all that happens, which is why we find this residual signal in the first place. The other thing is GLMs underrepresent interacting variables, and variables interact at a local level. So they're not globally interacting. It's not like we make variables, compound variables of some insured and age where they're globally compound. They'll only interact for very specific ranges of each variable. And that's what we find in the definitions of those segments, that variables interact locally, and lots of them interact locally. Five or six will interact locally in that way. The other thing I'd say is, as a conclusion to this, machine learning methods can be valuable supplements to GLMs. You're not going to change the nature of GLMs. People have been using those a long time now. But what we can do is use these methodologies as a supplement to them in order to correct for what the GLMs cannot represent and find the extra lift that's present in the data, so we can improve the fit of pure premiums as a result of this. There are some implications for this, finally, I think. One is the current GLM-based cost models, the pure premiums derived from GLMs, are inaccurate. We've done tests not only on this data set, but many others, and it always comes out about the same. They are just inaccurate. I would say that if you were extrapolating from these cost models, then the results can be unreliable. In other words, if you're doing price optimization and you're doing it based, you're optimizing prices based on a GLM-based cost model, then you may well be optimizing prices in some less than optimum manner. You may not be. You may be optimizing them well, but you may not be, given that the cost model is not actually right. And that's it, I think. For me. So if we've got questions, that's fine. Otherwise, we can all go and do something else.
So I'm still a little bit fuzzy as to how you came about with your view of 1,000 score. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that?
I can talk somewhat about that. So what actually happens is, instead of doing like a tree, imagine we were doing a tree in normal segmentation where we're doing classification and we get to the leaf nodes. So that only gives us point estimates. That gives us a piecewise constant function. If we could go away from that and at each leaf node be able to connect the whole thing up as a continuous function rather than as, remember we spoke about putting a linear regression at the end?
Yep.
If we could connect all this up as a continuous function, then we could derive continuous values depending on the height of this function over some baseline. And therefore, we could derive the baseline could be zero, and the top height, which we would define arbitrarily, would be 1,000. And we could grade all the responses out of this thing in that way.
Okay.
Yes?
Did you really try the so-called real hardware computation with GLM, meaning that the variables are exactly the same? That's so that the GLM uses six variables, you use six variables. Each variable here, we say that like primary GLMs that use five categories. I also here, I also use five categories. And use that to the real habitat computation to see what the actual lift you can get.
Yes, we have done that test as well. The lift is not as great as this, but the lift is still there. There's a significant lift left over just on the variables that were used by the GLM. And we use the same methodology of training data and validation data and measure the reliability on the validation data. So we've done both of those tests, A, limiting it just to the variables in the GLM, and then in this particular case we limited it to the variables that the actuaries had available to them, and they didn't use them all in the GLM, obviously. Yeah, but we've done both of those tests. But if we just limit it... Yes. Yes. Yeah, we've used the same buckets. We use the same buckets for the variables as the actuaries used. Yes.
In that case, how much of a lift? Yeah.
About half of this lift.
Half of the lift.
Yeah. Okay. What happens is, I think, because I speculate now, because what happens is we find that there are many locally interacting variables. They're easily missed in the modelling process that leads to the GLM because they find the most interacting variables that interact more globally, and those are the ones that are incorporated in the GLM. But lots of the other variables that are rejected in that process participate in there, and they participate. We can model that by using these methods to see how they participate. It's been interesting, all this research. Yes?
Have you tried not being individual but fitting the pure premium directly to CM? Is this type of technique actually used to build a rating plan as opposed to just modifying an existing rating plan?
Yes, we've tried to do that, to build a rating plan. It comes out about the same as the GLM. The strength of this methodology is finding interacting variables. And what the GLM does is does a very good job of most of the rest of it. So by using the GLM and this on top, we do a much better job than each of the methods alone could do. We have the implementation. So what happens in implementation terms is, no matter where we're talking about the point estimates or the continuous ones, we produce an executable module that comes out of that that actually does that classification. It's easy to automate. You know, once you know what the description of all of these things are, once you know the shape of that thing, you can just generate the code that does it.
Yep.
How complex are they? So they vary. So let me perhaps try to comment on that. And again, it's the trade-off between accuracy and description length. So in this particular case, it's more towards minimising description length because they need to be understandable. As I said, for most portfolios, we find 5 or 6 locally interacting variables, sometimes less. So the segments contain 5 or 6 premise statements that define them. Once we have those 5 or 6 premise statements, you can imagine premise statements are synonymous with SQL. You can translate backwards and forwards between premises and SQL. So therefore, it's easy for us to take the premise statements that come out of training, translate them to SQL, land them on the validation data, get that data and just look at the statistics. But the focus is on making them understandable. Yes, sorry. The best way to control it is via the continuous output methodology because you'll get a smooth function. So if you go with the piecewise constant function, you can get what are perceived to be reversals at times. But you have to remember at some stage, these are just relativities. Like people would. Let's imagine you go back to looking at driver age, which is the variable you spoke at. Most people would bucket that into values, not treat it as one continuous variable, but bin it. So in other words, at a certain boundary, you're going to change rate quite substantially, potentially. You try to choose those boundaries so that the rate changes aren't so great. But this is the same thing. This is only going to use the same boundaries in terms of the very first type of result. Remember, we used the same variable descriptors as the actuaries use. So we use the same buckets. Yes?
If you were training this for each year in the
Yep. The local interactions turn out to be the same almost universally through that data set. We've done that test. That's right. The local interactions turn out to be just about the same. Remember that all these models overfit to some degree, same as GLMs do, right? Everything we do overfits to some degree. So that the local interactions change subtly from year to year. Whether that's actually the world changing from year to year or whether that's just the like 10% overfit that we get out of this, it's difficult to tell one effect from the other. By and large, the same interactions, yeah.
Local interactions.
Oh, yeah.
And they it's
fairly robust. Oh, yeah. It certainly is. But that's the reason the signal's there consistently. And as I said, this is just one portfolio that we've used. There are lots of others.
It's just another
yep. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's go and do something else. Nice to meet you.
This is very exciting stuff.
Oh, thank you.
Great. Do you know, are there any published references from literature
to this?
To some of this?
In terms of classification learning, lots of that stuff is all there. It's in terms of the results that we have, look, I wrote a paper, which is where a lot of these results came from. But it's not published, and no one actually wants me to publish it. Because the methodologies are trade secret now. Oh, it's a pain. Like, yeah. The scientists, I don't like that. But,
I just thought it looked
something.
It's not like
it's owned by Eagle Eye now.
You know,
unfortunately, yes. It has some benefits and some drawbacks. As always, everything's a compromise.
Yes. No, but it's extremely exciting.
Oh, my pleasure.